And Obama certainly did that. You know, he made the Tea Party real through the bailouts, while they were bailing out the wealthy and abandoning the rest of the society and not offering an alternative vision. But of course, we need to recognize that labor and liberals also abandon all opposition to the class warfare agenda of Democrats and Obama, while the left is virtually non-existent, as at least as a national force. So the right had a huge opening to take advantage.
That's Arun Gupta, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Arun Gupta on the economic crisis and the Tea Party. You've played by the rules, went to work every day, paid your bills and taxes. When your country summoned you to fight in its wars, you were proud to serve. You've worked hard all your life, and now what do you get? Bupkis, as they say in Yiddish, goat droppings. Your job was outsourced overseas. Your house has been foreclosed. You're in debt. Meanwhile, the big banks are sitting pretty on tons of cash. The stock market and corporate profits are up. GE made billions in 2010 and didn't pay a dime in taxes. With this backdrop, in walks the Tea Party. They got the answers. You know why you're getting shafted? It's the immigrants, gays, uppity women, minorities, liberals, unions, and public service workers. This program is a classic from the AR archives, celebrating 25 years of independent broadcasting. To talk about these issues is Arun Gupta. He's a journalist and activist and founding editor of the independent newspaper in New York. He's a regular contributor to Alternet and Z. Arun Gupta spoke at Red Emma's bookstore in Baltimore.
What I want to do is to kind of historicize the Tea Party, and they cannot just be understood as a recent phenomena. One of the things that I've learned, both in terms of studying the right and interacting with people who consider themselves Tea Party activists, is the right generally hates history. They hate facts. They hate any sort of historical or social context. And that's why they often just constantly refer to as the Constitution and the Bible as all sources of legitimacy. And of course, for much of the right, the Constitution is seen almost as a biblical, or actually as a biblical document. There's an extreme disdain often for history, and there's a tremendous amount of fabrication that exists on the right. So even the process of trying to historicize the Tea Party is, I think, important for us to understand it, and it's important to understand that this is something that the right is not really interested in, and it's something that we need to figure out how to address. How do you deal with a force that, you know, fundamentally denies reality? So kind of any starting point is of course ultimately arbitrary. I choose a starting point of the economic and political crisis of the 1970s. That's what gave birth to the doctrine known as neoliberalism that came to fruition by the end of the decade with Margaret Thatcher in England and Ronald Reagan in the United States. Neoliberalism is, of course, a doctrine of privatization, privatizing government services, trade and capital liberalization, that we should liberalize capital's ability to move about, deregulation, the doctrine of personal responsibility, and flexibility, especially in regard to labor. So what happened in the 1970s, just very quickly, capital fled to low-wage regions around the world. The U.S. manufacturing workforce peaked at around 39 million in 1979. Just to put that in perspective, today it's maybe around 12 million. And, of course, the population is significantly larger. So this is a drop of somewhere somewhere around 70 to 75% in the manufacturing workforce. It fled to low-wage regions that also had few regulations on labor, environment, and movement of profits. Domestically, private sector unionism found itself under fierce assault, so capital could increase the use of part-time, temporary, and freelance workers. Union and environmental and safety regulations were also seen as limits on production, so those were smashed, so labor flexibility could be increased. And, you know, a lot of us, I imagine almost everyone in this room has dealt with it, or at one point or another, where you find yourself in temporary work, part-time work, contract work. The idea is that you can be added or shed very quickly by capital. And one of the things that was remarkable about, you know, I don't call it a recession, the depression that began in 2008 was the massive rate at which capital just shed jobs. It was shedding jobs at over 500,000 a month. And that doesn't include all the people who were involuntarily unemployed. At this point, even though, you know, we hear the talk in the corporate media that we're in recovery, the real unemployment rate, what's known as the U6 rate, the Labor Department tracks this, you can find it on their website. It includes unemployed, those who've stopped looking for jobs but want to be employed. The underemployed is about 16%, except what the Labor Department doesn't track. It doesn't track people who've involuntarily taken retirements. In other words, people who might have a small pension they could live on, some savings, who are hoping to bridge it to Social Security. And they don't include in this rate youth who have been unable to enter the workforce. There's also a shadow economy. So we're probably dealing with a real unemployment rate approaching 20%. Now, if we go back to the Great Depression, it was 25 to 30%. And this is a persistent, you know, this is called the new reality. So I think it's fair to say this is not a recession, or the term that the New York Times is popularized, the Great Recession. It really is a depression, especially on order of the 19th century depressions. And neoliberalism, of course, means new liberalism in terms of reference to the 19th century laissez-faire capitalist doctrine. And the reason we moved away from laissez-faire capitalism was you would have these devastating boom and bust cycles where you would have the economy expand, overproduction, and then depression after depression after depression. There were these panics and huge depressions in the latter half of the 19th century. And capitalism actually wanted regulation. It wanted central banking. It wanted the government to intervene because it was in its economic interest to stabilize the economy. And yet we are kind of moving back to this era. And the Tea Party does play a particularly critical role in terms of pushing a revival of 19th century laissez-faire economics. Capital now has this ability to literally move around the world at the speed of light. You know, capital in a lot of ways has become decentered. You can't even talk about a New York Stock Exchange anymore, for instance. Like, it takes investigative reporters to find out where the New York Stock Exchange is located, because it's now in computer server farms that might be in Illinois, they might be in Virginia, they might be in Iowa. It's even hard to find out where the trading is actually going on. And there have also been all these shadow markets that have grown up over the last 20 years. So capitalism just kind of endlessly, ceaselessly circles the globe looking for any outlet of profit. And it's not just the three basic forms of capitalism: financial capitalism, industrial capitalism, and merchant capitalism. And even industrial capitalism has an ability to move just from one region to another. Of course, it needs things like ports, roads, electricity, infrastructure, but given the ability, given how capital has leveled much of the world in terms of wages, in terms of regulation, it can now move from region to region to region. For instance, NAFTA was sold to Mexico as this is going to bring employment. And yes, there was a certain amount of employment that was bought to the low-wage, unregulated maquiladoras in northern Mexico. But at the same time, Mexico has been consistently losing employment in the maquiladoras over the last year. because capital, it can go to Central America, it can go to the Caribbean, it could go to Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia, Bangladesh, China. It can just keep going around and around and around because governments keep building these wage zones where they try and compete for various types of industrial capital and manufacturing capital to come in. So there is this process of where it can just keep moving around. And what this does, of course, is it pushes down wages and benefits because it seeks comparative advantage wherever it can get. You know, it goes to one region and then another government might try and entice it. Well, we have even lower wages. We have even less benefits. We have less regulation on the environment. We'll give you more tax breaks. We have a more modern infrastructure, and on and on and on. And this creates what's commonly called the race to the bottom. And I think certainly in this country, we're especially seeing that. There's been a big debate over, well, whether we are really in a race to the bottom because wages have sustained themselves somewhat. But I think really in the last couple of years, we are seeing, you know, another step in terms of that race to the bottom with lower wages, less benefits. You know, the average household income is declining, average wages are declining, benefits are under severe attack. So one of the results of the financialization is a series of asset bubbles, one right after the other. The savings and loan crisis, the internet bubble in the 1990s, and what happened after the internet bubble was the Federal Reserve cut interest rates to historic lows, and this fed the next bubble, which was the mortgage bubble. By cutting interest rates to historic lows, it encouraged a lot of refinancing, a lot of home building, and some home ownership. But especially what it really encouraged when interest rates were around 1%, they're even lower today, but It encouraged a lot of profiteering in debt-related securitization. So this is where you have the Wizards of Wall Street. They start to bundle credit card debt, car loan debt, student loan debt, and most of all mortgage debt, particularly commercial mortgages and residential mortgages. And they take, you know, thousands of loans, they bundle them, and then they sell off parts of this to investors. And what this did is you created this enormous appetite for more and more and more debt. So we had the debt-driven economy. And you also had the huge growth in derivatives during this era. And this is stuff like swaps, where you're taking a bet on whether a bond is going to fail or not. You have all sorts of derivatives, futures, options, huge explosion in currency trading and commodity trading. But it's really the mortgage driven speculation that starts to drive the economy. By the height of the, you know, in 2005 and 2006, you know, we're hearing, oh, the economy's expanding, you know, it's growing, there's this huge wealth being made. And something like 50% of new jobs, almost 50% of new jobs were coming from the home building industry and from mortgage securitization. So you had huge growths in terms of realtors, in terms of people who work these boiler room operations, you know, and are calling you 20 times a week trying to get you to refinance your mortgage. The construction industry, of course, the appliances, et cetera, places like Home Depot, et cetera. And this is really where the growth is coming from. And one of the important aspects to remember about this is a lot of what Wall Street is doing is what's called fictitious capital. In other words, they're creating this capital that isn't based on any actual production. But the thing is, though, when you look at it, it actually does have an effect on the productive sphere. And I'll talk about this a little more later, because we're now in two different bubbles right now. We're well into a bubble in terms of commodities and precious metals. Over the last decade, gold has gone from about $250 an ounce to nearly $1,500 an ounce. And, you know, gold is not really, it's a meaningless asset in a lot of ways. There's no reason why it should be $1,500 an ounce, but it could easily go to $5,000 an ounce, or what some people are speculating. Then the other bubble we're in is a commodities bubble, especially agricultural commodities, oil, land, industrial metals. But this can't absorb a lot of capital. In terms of the crisis that we had in 2008, 2009, what happens during a crisis, you wind up with surplus labor and surplus capital. And of course, we see the surplus labor in this country in the 25 to 30 million unemployed and underemployed, but you also have a surplus capital problem because the wealthy sit on an enormous amount of wealth. They usually have it in pretty safe assets. So right now, the what's known as ultra high net worth Americans, these are Americans who have $1 million in investable assets. This is completely exclusive of their homes. These are people who have a huge amount of liquid assets. They're sitting on $12 trillion of wealth, whereas corporations are running record profits. The last quarter, they were running an annual rate of corporate profits at $1.66 trillion a year. They're sitting on enormous cash reserves. So there's a problem. What do you do with all this money? You can't just let it sit around or it'll be destroyed. It'll be destroyed by inflation. It'll be devalued over time. You always have to look for some sort of place to be able to invest it. The commodities bubble is one. There's an absolutely enormous amount of money going into the emerging markets because there's no place else to put it. So there's huge flows of capital going into China, into India, Brazil, Russia, various African nations. And we can see how it's reshaping the world. Even though you have a lot of fictitious wealth being created, it then has an effect on the real world in terms of actually shaping it. You know, China, what's going on is phenomenal in terms of human history, the urbanization, the fact that it's literally been able to pull up cities of 10 million, 20 million people in just a decade or two. At one point, something like half the construction cranes in the world were in Shanghai. You know, it's really unprecedented in human history what is going on in China. And the problem is, though, with each asset bubble, you get a greater and greater crash. So the amount of wealth that was wiped out during the internet bubble that popped in 2000 was about $10 trillion. The amount of wealth that was wiped out in the financial assets bubble, the mortgage bubble in 2008, was about $50 trillion. To put that in perspective, that's the annual output of the entire global economy. You know, so who knows? The thing is, if an emerging market bubble eventually inflates and then is destroyed, there is absolutely no mechanism to deal with it on a global scale. So we are really setting ourselves up for, you know, the mother of all economic crises, you know, whether that's 5, 10, or 20 years down the road. So I was talking a little bit about surplus labor, the amount of unemployment. You know, one thing to note is that what's known the capacity utilization rate, that's basically how much of factories and the manufacturing sphere is being used. Nearly three years after the crisis hit the bottom in late 2008, we are still below a capacity utilization rate of 1990 to 1991 recession. You know, so there is what this means effectively is there is a large surplus capacity, and this is a real problem for capitalism. You know, if you already have a large surplus capacity, if you can already create all sorts of cars, all sorts of steel, all sorts of semiconductors, consumer electronic goods, and nobody's buying them, then who wants to invest in new factories? You know, even though there's all this talk about, you know, from the right, Obama, you know, the Democrats, we need new tax investments, we need new investment in business. But when you already have this huge overcapacity, what's the point? Businesses aren't going to invest. They have no need to invest. You know, a lot of this overcapacity has to be destroyed. And historically, a lot of the way it gets destroyed is through warfare. And that plays a critical role, of course, in the cycles of capitalism, the way the warfare state and actual large-scale military conflicts helps to renew the capitalist system. We in this country have keep relying on that. You know, I think it would be interesting to actually do an investigation how much of the manufacturing workforce is directly employed in military industries. Or take a take the Bush Wars. During the era of the Bush Wars, it was often this slogan on the left was we're losing all this blood and treasure. And after a while, I started to become really uncomfortable with that notion of losing treasure, because when you start to look at the supplemental appropriations, where the U.S. government was spending an extra $100-200 billion a year on more, if you were looking where it was actually going, it was actually going into all this production. It was going to factories in Ohio to make new Humvees. It was going to factories in Texas to make new Black Hawk helicopters. It was going to the huge defense industry in Southern California to make missiles, to repair fighter planes. So in many ways, this was an actual jobs program that was going on during the Bush administration. Of course, it's the most type of destructive and inefficient jobs program imaginable. But the notion that, that these wars are just an entire waste, we shouldn't view that as entirely true, that they actually have, they serve a productive role, and they also, of course, serve a great ideological role because of the number of people who are employed either as soldiers or as mercenaries or as private contractors. You create this huge base of support across the country for continuing these wars because people's livelihoods are directly related to it. The whole point of the economic crisis in terms of how it was dealt with has been an attack on the public sector, on unions, on social welfare. When the bubble started to burst in 2008, the way that the Federal Reserve, the government, the economic elite, their stance was, we just need to solve the problem. We need to keep the banking and commercial system whole. And sure, there is a certain truth to that. See, the banking system is kind of the heart for capitalism. You have to keep it going. But of course, when it came time to figure out who's going to pay, well, again, we know how that story went. But it's first of all important to think about just went on in the last decade. First, the banks and the wealthy make these huge profits off basically an economy that's a giant pyramid scheme, right? You constantly have more money coming in, and that the profits keep flowing up. But eventually, you run out of suckers. What happened was by 2006, 2007, you ran out of people who are going to take mortgages because. Basically, everyone who could take a mortgage had taken a mortgage. So it starts to collapse. The people on the bottom are left holding the bag. And over the last 5 or 6 years, we've actually seen the greatest destruction of African-American wealth in American history. It's been absolutely devastating what's happened to the African American community, and it's gotten very little attention. Huge parts of urban middle class neighborhoods across the country, especially in the on the East Coast and in the Midwest, have just been utterly clear cut of African Americans because many were pressured, tricked, or enticed into taking these risky arms mortgages, the adjustable rate mortgages, where you get this teaser rate and then it explodes after a year or two. And of course, in the way that Wall Street works, this money flows upward. So, but the bubble bursts. We, of course, first had to pay with the huge bailouts. The TARP was just the smallest of which. It depends on how you count it. The TARP, the Troubled Asset Relief Program, that was, of course, passed by the Bush administration. And here's, a good example. Something like 35 or 40% of Republicans think that the TARP was opposed by the Republican Party. There was a segment of the Republican Party who did oppose it, but this was the Bush administration that passed it. Of course, you know, Obama was 100% behind it while McCain waffled. But nonetheless, this was the Republicans who passed it initially. Now, there are all sorts of various counts of how much the government has directly and indirectly subsidized the financial sector. The person who's done the best work on this is this financial analyst named Nomi Prinz. She used to be a managing director at Goldman Sachs. You can find her work on Wall Street, on Mother Jones, where she details something like over 70 different programs put in place by the Federal Reserve, the FDIC, and the Treasury Department. I think according to the last time I looked, it's something like $23 trillion. Now, a lot of that is just loan guarantees. It's backstopping credit. So direct subsidies, it's a little harder to say, but it is in the trillions of dollars that directly went into Wall Street. And I don't know if anybody saw the rather, you know, ridiculous. The story itself wasn't ridiculous in the New York Times. It was a pretty good report about how there have been zero cases bought against any of this financial fraud. And of course, this all depended on massive financial fraud. What Lehman Brothers did, what Bear Stearns did, what all these banks did, what was happening in the mortgage industry, huge financial fraud. And not one person has been brought to task yet. There were regulators apparently telling prosecutors, well, you know, don't go after them because they didn't want to have the sight of banks paying fines with government money is one reason that prosecutors were told not to apparently to go after the banking industry. But overall, the whole approach of the government has been to let them go scot-free in terms of what happened. So the first thing was to make the public directly pay, which was to pay back shareholders and bondholders to make them whole. In one case, when AIG collapsed, they're the ones who had taken out, had backed a huge amount of swaps. And I'll explain swaps real quickly because it's a good thing to understand. Say you're General Motors and you're floating corporate bonds all the time, you know, to back payroll, to back manufacturing, to building new factories. Say you issue a $10 million bond. GM decides, well, we want to take insurance on this in case, you know, we end up defaulting on it. So they go to a company like AIG. They take insurance. Maybe they have to pay, you know, 1 or 2%. So they have to pay $100,000 or $200,000. And if they default, then the bondholders, then AIG makes the bondholders whole. That's what the role it plays. Now, what you started to happen during this just tremendous speculative boom that went on in the last decade, for one, people were taking swaps that the companies didn't even know about. There started to be a huge market trading in the swaps such that no one knew who held the insurance on these bonds. And two, you started to actually start to have bets on the swaps. That's you know, you start to have a derivative of a derivative. You know, a derivative just means you're deriving something from an underlying asset, where you're, say, you're betting on the future price of corn. That's a derivative. These swaps are also derivatives. You're making a bet on the underlying asset, the bond. But then you started to have second and third order derivatives, and you started to have these secretive and shadow markets. So when AIG started to collapse, the Treasury Department came in. And, you know, normally what you would do in this case is you would have the companies take a haircut. That's the jargon of the industry. In other words, that they should only get paid a dime on the dollar, 20 cents on the dollar, 30 cents on the dollar. The federal government decided, and even in the markets that were pricing these swaps, they were only something like, it varied, but I think it was something like 20 to 50 cents on the dollar, even sometimes less, depending what the swap was. Well, the Treasury Department decides to make them entirely entirely whole. In other words, they pay back 100 cents on the dollar, even though the markets were valuing them at far less. And of course, this is kind of the role of government, is to transfer wealth upwards, or at least what the role of government has become. So that's the first way, make the public pay. The second way is through the debt. So you've transferred all this money to the wealthy. Well, the government needs to pay for it somehow, so it floats bonds. But who's going to buy bonds? Well, the rich buy the bonds. So now you've given them money a second way, because you pay interest rate on the bonds. So the rich and corporations and large institutions are profiting a second way. Now, the third thing that happens is we're told, oh, well, now we all have to share the pain. Of course, we're all sharing the pain of the super rich while they're making record profits. They're enjoying record wealth. So social services start to be decimated. This process, of course, goes back to the Reagan-Thatcher era. But now we're seeing a new round. And the Republicans have come out, you know, with yet another new attack, that they completely want to destroy Medicare and Medicaid.
You're listening to Arun Gupta, The Economic Crisis and the Tea Party. This is Alternative Radio. You can order copies of this program by calling our toll-free number, 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order online on our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org.
But the way we should understand the attack on social services, it's one, it's to discipline labor. Two, it's to put the cost of social reproduction back on the workforce. In other words, you get a wage, you are entirely responsible for your housing, for your food, for your education, for your health care, for your retirement, for your transportation, and on and on and on. And if you don't get enough, well, that's your problem, because you're too lazy, you didn't work hard enough, you didn't take advantage of the opportunities given to you. So this becomes a method to discipline labor. And what also happens is, because of this, because the costs of social reproduction start to come down, not for the workers, but for the government. And because capital is able to make people more desperate, more contingent, it leads to a cut in wages and benefits. You know, when you have such high unemployment and underemployment, you can cut wages and benefits further, which results in greater corporate profits. So the rich benefit a third way. And of course, they benefit a fourth way through the lowering of corporate taxes, you know, that we've seen. You know, Obama, like, he ran on basically one pledge. You know, his signature pledge was he was going to repeal the Bush-era tax cuts, and yet he renewed them. And we're seeing the same thing where I live in New York State, where Andrew Cuomo backed a repeal of a millionaire's tax, even though something like $1.5 billion is being cut from education and health care. They're still repealing the millionaire's tax, so millionaires can get more money. And of course, they don't even really use the justification, oh, it creates jobs anymore, because how can you say that, again, when you have 25 to 30 million unemployed and underemployed? So in all these different ways, the rich benefit, but there's still other reasons why there's this attack on social services and the public sector. We have to, and this is where we start to really get into an understanding of the Tea Party. The role the public sector plays, of course, is they're the one who are carrying out these social services, right? You know, it's the teachers who are carrying out the public education. It's the social workers, the doctors, nurses, medical personnel who work in the public hospital, all the various administrators and personnel who work in the public services. So it's kind of this two-part effort. You want to cut the social services as much as possible, and you want to cut the workforce as much as possible, a two-prong attack. But there's also a very important role, again, that we need to be aware of. It's to destroy what we can call the infrastructure of dissent. And that is to basically deny people the capacity to have mass resources to oppose what's going on. And unions are, I think, in how they operate are highly problematic. You know, the American labor movement has basically serves this role as a junior partner to capital and keeps begging capital, please, you know, can't we work with you, even as capital keeps trying to destroy it. But nonetheless, it has a potential to organize a lot of people in terms of massive dissent. For instance, during the last two election cycles, nobody knows the exact number, but it's estimated that the labor movement, and this is the big unions, you know, like the AFL-CIO or SEIU or AFSCME, which is the public sector unions, it's estimated they poured over $500 million into the Democratic Party. Now, there's just simply no force on the left that has that amount of money. The amount of money available to unions is huge, you know, because there, even though the percentage of the workforce that's unionized is something like 8%, that still means over 10 million workers are paying dues to unions. The amount of assets that they theoretically have at their disposal is something in the range of $10 billion. Though, to put that in perspective, you could take any two banks on Wall Street, and they paid more in bonuses in 2008, just in bonuses, than all union assets combined. So in one way, it's a huge amount of money, but in another way, it's not a huge amount of money. I think one of the most overlooked aspects of what's going on in terms of the economic crisis, and again, this relates directly to the Tea Party movement, is gender relations. At least in the initial phases of this economic crisis, 80% of the job losses were accounted for by men. Men were losing the jobs, women were losing wages and benefits, because women were generally often concentrated in the contingent workforce already, right? So they were already temporary, they were already part-time. They weren't seeing greater job losses so much as they were seeing their wages cuts or their benefits cut further. But this has had a significant effect. For example, for the first time in U.S. history, or at least modern U.S. history, there are now more unmarried Americans from age 18 to 34 than there are married Americans. These are the prime childbearing years. Now, and there's, you know, a simple reason for a lot of this. You know, women are an increasing percentage of, they're a majority of the college-age population, and they're growing. They're also growing rapidly in all sorts of professional fields in terms of gender relations. Now, one thing I found curious is, you know, you find this absolutely vicious attack by the right on reproductive rights that's going on, but it's seen as somehow separate from the economic crisis, and I actually think that they're intimately intertwined, because essentially men's identity is seen as under attack, right? They're no longer the breadwinners. This country is becoming a majority minority at a rapid pace. And so these vicious attack on reproductive rights, even trying to redefine rape, which Republicans have been doing at the state level, is a way to reconstruct male identity and male power. And, you know, we have to be aware of how these different influences play out. Similarly, you know, the national identity, we see the reconstruction of that in terms of the anti-immigration movement, the Islamophobia movements in this country. It's a way to give people a sense of social power. And I'll delve into this further. But, you know, the Tea Party, it's an extremely white movement. By various counts, it's 94% to 98% white. And in my anecdotal experience, it is extremely white. So by having these vicious anti-immigration movements, you know, you give people a sense that they have an identity, they have some sort of social power, maybe their job prospects are declining or ending, you know, maybe they're not wanted as a mate by someone, you know, they're lonely, but being able to act out their aggression against someone else gives them a sense of belonging in the public sphere. I think we have to understand how these things are intimately linked, because this gets to the heart of what the Tea Party movement is about and how we need to learn why they have had so much success Now, I'm going to talk about the Tea Party in five interlocking frames: historical, social, political, ideological, and psychological. First, historical. The Tea Party is classic reactionary movement, and that goes back to the French Revolution. I recently read Eric Hobsbawm's The Age of Revolution, terrific book, and I was just struck by, you know, in a lot of ways we're still fighting the French Revolution, except the right is winning and the left has disappeared or has surrendered. Because what the right, especially the reactionary right, is still about is it opposes progress and it idealizes a society based on tradition and hierarchy. So the early reactionaries in the 19th century defended the church, the king, the aristocracy, and property. Reactionaries today defend property, the market, Christianity, whiteness, American exceptionalism, and privileges based on race, gender, nationality, and often heterosexuality. Now, we can also historicize the Tea Party movement in terms of the modern American right. We have to understand that there's these upsurges again and again and again. There was the right around the Goldwater campaign in 1964. Then, of course, with George Wallace, this very racist white supremacist right in the mid-60s that Nixon was able to peel off a lot of into his silent majority. His was kind of, you know, a kinder, gentler racist right, where they use the term benign neglect, you know, that they weren't going to be overtly racist, but they would just kind of neglect the minority communities that were repressed. And of course, we had the Reagan Revolution and the Christian right, you know, which was very much about enforcing these traditional normative and largely imagined ideas of how family and the society should operate. There was a 1990s Republican Revolution led by Newt Gingrich, and of course the growth of the militia movements, and now we've had the Tea Party movement. Of course, the thing is, we need to understand that in each of these phases also, it's often the Democrats are enabling and creating the political space for the next phase of the right. Clinton did that with the Republican Revolution in 1994. Carter certainly did that he played that role in terms of creating the ground that Reaganism was able to successfully occupy. And Obama certainly did that. He made the Tea Party real through the bailouts, while they were bailing out the wealthy and abandoning the rest of this society and not offering an alternative vision. But of course, we need to recognize that labor and liberals also abandon all opposition to the class warfare agenda of Democrats and Obama, while the left is virtually non-existent at least as a national force. So the right had a huge opening to take advantage. And, you know, I think a lot of times people hear class warfare, they're like, well, you know, that's just rhetoric. But I would remind them that just a few years ago, Warren Buffett said, there's class warfare going on in this country. It's my class that's fighting it, and it's my class that's winning it. So when you have the richest man in America saying that that his class is engaging and winning class warfare, I think we can all agree that that's part of the fundamental reality. So the social aspects of the Tea Party, if you look at the polling data, and this is what I found confirmed through my anecdotal evidence in terms of going to Tea Party meetings, it is overwhelmingly white. Like I said, up to 98% white, if not more. It trends male. It's a slightly above average income, mostly Republican, 60-70% or more, much older, many retirees, and they tend to, but they're not always entrepreneurial and Christian. And the Tea Party, though, is at least in terms of the right, a very diverse movement. So some areas you might find the Christian right predominates, some areas you might find the libertarian right predominates, some areas, especially, say, out in the West, it's more kind of this rugged individualism ethos. So you have to look at particular regions in terms of who identifies as the Tea Party. And these are people who are doing pretty decently. They're often entrepreneurial, but they see themselves as under attack, both socially and economically. And this has a couple of important aspects I'll talk about in terms of how they view economic relations. But ultimately, what it is also, it's a very dangerous cry of an older white America that's fading away as the country does become truly multi-ethnic, particularly Latino. It's very exclusionist, nativist, racist, often violently so. The Tea Party movement has huge overlaps with the anti-immigrant movement, with the Islamophobia movements. So it is very much a reactionary movement. And it's defense of this ideal of a white middle-class nuclear family where children obeyed authority, blacks were submissive, women were limited to strict gender and social role, immigrants assimilated or unknown, and the white wage-earning patriarchal male was the ruler of the home and the middle-class neighborhood. The political aspect. Another way to understand the right, the modern right, the reactionary right, and the Tea Party is simply put that it's against the downward redistribution of wealth and power and for enforcing order and discipline in the social sphere, politics, and the economy. Now, it's really remarkable when you look at all the groups that the right attacks. You know, it's unions, it's women, it's lesbian and gays, it's immigrants, Latinos, blacks, Muslims. It just goes on and on and on, like all the different groups they attack. And there's a commonality in terms of they oppose any sort of redistribution of power and wealth. But two, they have this amazing ability to just constantly keep circulating who the particular scapegoat of the moment is. And the left and liberals are always trying to play catch up. You know, one day it's welfare mothers. The next day it's feminists. Another day it's bureaucrat. You know, then it's the unions. And we have to understand how they have such an adaptability. Of course, I'm not talking about the huge natural advantages the Tea Party has in having huge resources behind them, in having an enormous national platform through Fox News and the huge right-wing echo chamber. But nonetheless, there is kind of a coherent ideology there. It's a scary ideology, but there's a coherent one we need to be aware of. Another way to understand the political ideology of the Tea Party, and this is very important. They are very racist, they are very reactionary, but they have what can be called a chauvinistic universalism. And it's wrapped up in a very simple saying that they love to use again and again, which is, quote, equality of opportunity does not guarantee equality of outcome. So they're saying, like, you know, it's this belief in the meritocracy that, you know, everybody has an equal opportunity. Of course, this doesn't account for historical oppressions. This doesn't account for, you know, for slavery and American apartheid that existed well into the 1960s. Doesn't account for the social, economic, political repression of women, etc. So that's the chauvinistic aspect, but they are trying to frame something as universal, and a lot of people do find it appealing. And I have seen some people of color within the Tea Party movement who are fully behind this. You know, yeah, we, you know, everyone has equality of opportunity. That doesn't mean that, you know, equal outcomes are guaranteed. The fourth aspect, ideological. These can just be summed up in you know, simple concepts, libertarianism. Like I mentioned earlier, the Tea Party is very much about a libertarian ideology. In other words, completely get the government out of the way, let the free market rule, absolutely no regulation, no limits. That's because they see the market as the guarantor of freedom and liberty. And of course, you know, hey, we can try that, but, you know, we've been there and done that, and that's what led to the Robin Baron era. That's what Dickensian England was like. That's just a huge disparities between wealth and poverty, but of course, which we're seeing again. Another way to encapsulate their ideology is social Darwinism, you know, that in other words, that somehow that the market and society naturally selects. If you're poor, well, then you are not as evolved. You've lost the natural selection of the market. They also have what could be called a neo-Malthusian ideology. You know, everyone's kind of familiar with Malthus, and they think it's, oh, it has to do with natural limits. In other words, that population growth outstrips food supply. That wasn't what Malthus's essays were actually about, his essays on population. He was arguing against aid to the poor, and that's very much what the Tea Party is about, that there shouldn't be no more aid to the poor, because you just... you encourage indolence, you encourage sloth. And so Malthus was like, we need to stop giving aid to the poor because we just encourage them to procreate and create ever more poor. So you're going to have more poor you need to support. And so that very much, I think, you see that kind of that neo-Malthusian ideology present within the Tea Party. Now, one of the most important aspects is the psychological aspect, and I think this is particularly where we need to pay attention, because the left does a very poor job of dealing with psychology. Generally, the left is very economistic. It wants to reduce everything to economic relations. It's a crude materialism, non-dialectical. In other words, we don't see the dialectic between material relations, which of course are fundamentally important, and ideas. You know, one of the things we need to pay attention to is, of course, what's going on, the Arab Spring. I mean, this shows the power of ideas, the way it's just spread from one country to the next. And people are fundamentally, I would argue, motivated by ideas. It's ideas, it's hope that give them ability to change the world, to imagine new forms of social relations. And we saw that briefly in Wisconsin. So we have to understand the dialectical relationship. The left also tends to focus on what can be called biological reductionism, that the type of issues we fight for have to do with our social reproduction. So we fight for better housing, for access to food, for health care, for education, for clean water. All very important, but that's not the sum of it. You know, what is the good life? You know, we don't even ask ourselves that anymore on the left. You know, what is the good life anymore? What type of lives? Why do we want everyone to have, you know, these... to be able to have a minimum standard, you know, a decent life, to be able to have housing, to be able to have proper health care. There still has to be a greater good beyond that, and we need to talk about that. So in terms of the Tea Party, the psychology of it, it's just look at the name, the Tea Party. It's, of course, referencing the Boston Tea Party. It's for a national refounding. And this is, like I said, the funny thing. They absolutely venerate the Constitution. They think the Constitution is some sort of holy document. In that kind of famous video that Sarah Palin did after Gabriel Giffords was shot, it's the one she relayed from her cave in Alaska, she referred to the Constitution as a sacred document. And so they really see the Constitution as kind of the complete foundation of our society. And what they're trying to do by this refounding is they want to address personal and national impotence through a return to a traditional values, and hence a return to power. There's a desire on their part to restore order across the various spheres of society. They want people to be disciplined, you know, that we should value sacrifice. So this is all the thing about, this is why we need to cut services. We have to live within our means, that there is a virtue, you know, to being able to live within your means, that you pay your bill on time, that you are able to pay your mortgage, you know, that if necessary, you all kind of join together and, you know, share. You know, it's this very idealized notion. To the last generation, the next generation is always lazy, right? Kids are always lazy. You know, they don't know the value of hard work. You know, but you see this a lot in the anti-immigration debate. You know, it's just like immigrants are fundamentally woven throughout our society, and a lot of it is because they will do the jobs that other Americans don't want to do. You know, who's going to work in the fast food restaurants? Who's going to harvest the fields, pick the fruits from the orchard, do domestic domestic labor, do a lot of the very hard menial labor in industries, etc. Well, you know, the anti-immigrant right is like, well, Americans will do it, you know, even though if we were somehow able to magically get rid of all undocumented immigrants, our economy would probably be on the brink of collapse within a week. But, you know, their attitude is, well, you know, kids today need to learn the value of hard work. They need to do this. I did this when I was young. And these ideas have great appeal. And we have to understand that the Tea Party isn't just a fabrication. There's often this notion that, oh, the Tea Party, because they have so much wealth behind, you know, because of the Koch brothers, you know, these brothers who are worth nearly $100 billion are pouring so much into Tea Party groups, because of Fox News, because of the Republican Party, the Tea Party is just an astroturf group. In other words, it's completely fake. And it's like, that's not entirely true. They're astroturf elements, but they have a perspective that speaks to tens of millions of Americans. And like I said, it's scary, it's repressive, it's a fantasy, and it's based on the fundamental rejection of reality. You know, for instance, most Republicans don't even think global warming is real, which of course is absolutely absurd, when every single bit of data shows more and more and more that we are destabilizing the entire biosphere and the climate, and yet they don't think it's real. There's this fundamental rejection of reality. But still, they have a clear ideology, and they explain social relations in a way that appeals to tens of millions of Americans.
Thank you.
That was Arun Gupta on the economic crisis and the Tea Party. He spoke at Red Emma's bookstore in Baltimore. Arun Gupta, journalist and activist, was founding editor of the Independent newspaper in New York. He's a regular contributor to Alternet and Z. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an unembedded award-winning weekly series based in Boulder, Colorado, celebrating 25 years on the air. Since we began broadcasting in 1986, we've always offered AR free to all public and community radio stations in the United States and the rest of the world. AR is independent. Our sole source of financial support comes directly from listeners just like you. That's why we can do programs such as the one you just heard, or airing a month of Howard Zinn classics, or digitizing our vast Noam Chomsky archive. AR features such voices as Helen Caldicott, Bill Moyers, Chris Hedges, Arundhati Roy, and David Corton. To access our complete audio archive, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we're podcasting, alternativeradio.org. To place a credit card order for a CD, MP3, or written transcript of Arun Gupta, Economic Crisis and the Tea Party, just call us toll-free at 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. Or you can order on our secure website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Series theme music is performed by the Kronos Quartet from Pieces of Africa. Stephanie Brown is our editor. I'm David Barsamian. Thank you for listening.